Today we're going to start a new block. That's the block that I call Quantum Collect Calling. But this block is a little bit about communication. So how do we communicate when we communicate through massless fields? Oftentimes, some people may be satisfied with like, oh yeah, well, I do something here, goes at the speed of light, and then somehow do something there, and then it works and it's communication. Or people use this picture coming from a classical view, I guess, in which you send a pulse, and the pulse travels at the speed of light, and then the pulse is received, right? And then there's not much else said about the nature of the communication. So what we're gonna do here is we're gonna try to delve on, I guess, the non-expected nature, or the non-trivial, I guess, that's something that could be anticipated just with this kind of classical intuition, nature of communication through a massless quantum field. And we're going to begin with a perturbative approach to it. So we're gonna see what is the leading order communication. How do you conceive communication through a massless field? It might not have two particle, we talked about particle detectors, right? So particle detectors exchange information through the quantum field. How is the idea, how do you conceive this to happen? So what kind of process do you think about it, right? When you think about communication? I'm going to guess that the way you probably would think about it is, oh yeah, I have detector A, couples to the field here, emits photons, those photons travel to B, and B captures those photons. Is that the way you would picture it? Seems a reasonable way, no? That way is strongly reliant on classical intuition. And that way is not the leading order contribution to communication through massless fields. And we're gonna see what the leading order actually is and why this picture of emitting a photon, capturing a photon is not really the leading order contribution. All right, to communication anyways. So let's recall a little bit things that, oh, parentheses that don't close. One, two. Okay, so let's start in by recalling things that we've seen in other lectures. So we remember the physics of particle detectors. We have two particle detectors that are, you can think of them as atoms, that couple to a quantum field. And this is the interaction Hamiltonian that couples the two detectors to the field. I have a sum over detectors, and every detector couples to the field through its monopole moment here. That's what we call mu, coupled to the scalar field. Okay, I don't even need to assume massless scalar field here. I'm gonna do it in general, but we're gonna focus, of course, on communication through massless fields. Initial state, well, let's assume a reasonable state for communication, which is the most general possible and correlated. I don't want to cheat or anything. I don't want to use correlations here. I'm gonna just assume, yeah, no, I have my detector. I put it in contact with the field. I have my other detector put it in contact with the field. They didn't know anything about each other until the protocol started. So we start from a fully uncorrelated state. In the derivation, I'm gonna do it like with this state, actually, which is uncorrelated between the detectors and the field. But at some point, I will assume that the detectors were also initially uncorrelated. Okay, but other than that, general, I'm not assuming any state for the field. Oh, it's an arbitrary density matrix. Only thing is that it's completely uncorrelated. It's a product state. All right. Now, we discussed how to start a perturbative approach on this. We did it through the Dyson expansion. We commented there are other ways in which you can do perturbative expansions. Dyson expansion is one of them. Okay, the Dyson expansion. Actually, for this, maybe the Magnus expansion could be more suited, but let's do it with the Dyson expansion because it's enough and very practical for what I want to do. The density matrix of the total system, of the full system, which is two detectors and the field, at a time t, capital T, if you want, well, t as in the final, like time evolution, then of course this time scale t will be encoded in the switching function, if you remember, it's in the support of the switching function. Anyway, so we have the initial state, we have a first order correction, a second order correction, and corrections of higher order. Now, what is the first order at which we would expect anything related to communication between the two detectors? Question, could it be order one? Could it be row one? Could row one be doing something related to communication? What do you think? Opinions? No opinions? Row one? Well, at first order, all that's going to happen is that one of the detectors will see the field. The other detector will see the field as well. But there's going to be no influence of the second detector on the first, or on the first detector on the second. A leading order, so the talking with the field has to happen at least at second order. In terms of amplitude of probability, the first order detector A will see the field, do something to the field. Detector B will do something to the field. The back reaction of the action of A on B will only happen at second order. Or in other words, this thing is going to be a sum of things that are proportional to lambda A plus things proportional to lambda B. Communication has to be proportional to both. Very easy to see. If I disconnect one of the detectors, so it might make the coupling of the first detector zero, okay, I cancel all the terms proportional to lambda A, then there's no effect on the lambda B, on the detector lambda B at first order, okay? So at first order, we have no terms. First order, no signaling, let's call it signaling terms. All right, the first order signaling terms have information about lambda A and lambda B, all right? You will not communicate if you make lambda A zero, you will not communicate if you make lambda B zero. The leading order terms to signaling will happen at second order. Now, luckily, we already saw this second order density matrix, well, the second order correction to the time evolved density matrix when we were seeing harvesting. Okay, this expression. Oh, of course, I haven't defined this calligraphic W. The calligraphic W, x nu t x eta t prime, is the pullback of the Wyman function, the smear trajectory of the detector. So, integral over space. Of first switching second switching and then the Wyman trace over the field of field and the initial state of the field. This is what we call the Wyman function of the original state. All right, the two-point function, the two-point correlator of the field. All right, so the first thing we want to do is to separate here terms that are going to be involved in communication. Now again, the terms that will be involved in communication would be the terms that are proportional to lambda A and lambda B. Terms that are proportional only to lambda A square or lambda B square are going to contribute to noise if we want, but are not going to contribute to the signal. Okay, so let's separate the noise from the things that are possibly contributing to the signal, okay? Separate noise from signal. All right. So, what we do is the second order contribution, the second order correction to the time-evolved density matrix for the detectors. I'm going to separate it into something that is proportional to lambda A, lambda B, Let me call this little thing signal, or maybe press signal. It's got the potential to contain signal in, the influence of detector A on detector B, okay? Plus terms that are noise. Okay. Terms that are proportional to either lambda A square, lambda B square. Of course, this row AB, this, I'm doing here all my strength and still. This is just at a time t. This is the trace over the field. That D here, yeah, of course, I call it D here, but I mean detector, so the notation I'm using here is AB. All right. This came from tracing out the field from the total timeable density matrix. Okay. All right. Any questions so far of what I'm doing right now? And separating terms that may lead to signaling, terms that will modify the density matrix of B, have the potential to modify density matrix of B in a way that depends on A, on the presence of A. That's what we call signaling. That has to be proportional to both lambda A, lambda B, from things that are local, things that are proportional only to lambda B squared, lambda A squared. Okay? All right. All right. Let's do some simplification. The simplification comes assuming that, well, we're talking about communication. So in the particular case that A and B don't have overlap, so this thing simplifies a lot. So let's assume for simplicity A switches, they're commoving, so switches on in this simple scenario earlier than B, and their switchings do not overlap. In time. Okay? This is just for simplicity of what we want to do here. Let me just illustrate. So this thing is XB. This thing is XA, which I put here as zero. Okay, and what I'm saying is that, well, lambda A, this thing is, maybe I'll write it here. This thing is the support of the switching of A. All right. And this thing, let's say, I don't know, something like that. This is the support of the switching of B. All right, so what I'm assuming here is that they do not overlap. Just to simplify the calculations a little bit for what we want to see is enough. Okay. Again, two commoving detectors, stationary inertial detectors in the frame XT, TX, with non-overlapping switchings. Okay. Now, we assume that, then with a loss of generality, let's say that A switches the interaction first. Let's say A is the emitter, B is the receiver. Okay? That's kind of a very, I mean, it's a it simplifies things, but it's also not very unrealistic. You usually have an emitter that sends a signal, and then a receiver that receives the signal later on. Okay, so this is basically the simplification I'm doing here. They weren't on before. That's kind of irrelevant. What they were doing before the signal arrives is irrelevant, so it's not a very strong simplification. Okay? In terms of, it's not a very strong assumption. So let's assume that A switches on first. So with that assumption, what I call rho 2 press signal becomes equal to minus infinity to infinity dt, dt prime minus infinity to infinity. And then we have the two switchings. Okay. And then this multiplies the calligraphic Wyman xb t prime xa t. And then I have ma t, whoa, the hat, t rho ab0 mb t prime minus mb t prime ma t rho ab0 plus the calligraphic Wyman xa t xb t prime and mb t prime rho ab0 m a t minus rho ab0 m a t mb t prime. Right, so basically with this simplification, what we did, we could denest that integral over there. So you see there was a nested integral, assuming that the two detectors don't have switching overlap. We can denest that very simply and write this expression as you can see here. Any questions? Yeah.
I have a couple of questions.
Go.
The first one, why is it pre-signal?
Because it contains other things other than signaling. It contains the terms that will yield to entanglement harvesting that, as you know, can happen space-like. And that is not something you can use to communicate. So we will get the signal one when we trace A and look at the density matrix of B. Okay. So if we look at the local, so that thing contains correlations between A and B as well as the signaling terms. When we trace A, then we're going to get a density matrix of B. Anything that's in there that depends on A is a signaling term. It will allow you to do local measurements on B and figure out stuff about A.
Okay.
And that's what that will be the raw signal,
okay,
if we want.
And then the other thing is the bounds on these integrals are like kind of all over the place. Like, shouldn't it be minus infinity to t on the
side? That's the point that I was discussing right here. It's minus infinity to t here. Under the assumptions that the two switchings don't have overlap, you can simplify it to this, extending the integral over here. Basically, the integral from t to infinity is zero in that case because of the no support of one over the other.
The one up there on the top left, but that one should have been to t, right?
No. This is the, remember, rho 2 has two contributions. One that comes from u1, rho 0, u1 dagger.
Yes.
U1 contains minus infinity to infinity. And this is the part, so maybe I could clarify that. This thing comes from u1, rho 0, u1 dagger.
Yeah.
This thing comes from u2, rho 0, plus rho 0, u2 dagger. Okay, so here you have nested integrals, here you do not. Those are good questions. It's good to clarify those things. Any more questions? All right. Yeah, the limits are all right. Okay, so. Nice, so we have this expression for the presignaling term if we want. Let's go to what I would call signal, finally. Oh, just a bit up, yeah. So, let's define rho b signal. The contribution to the density matrix of B, well, the leading order contribution to the density matrix of B that is proportional to lambda A and lambda B. So this is a local term. This is the real deal. If you measure here and you have any dependence on this density matrix on A, you are signaling. You are telling B something about A. Is that clear? Why this or so? This thing is the trace over A of rho AB presignal. Oh, well, I call it presignal only. All right, now this is the real signal in here. I removed, so rho per signal contains information about both things that are signaling for real and correlations between A and B, such as the ones that we saw when we saw entanglement harvesting, okay? That live in the non-local terms in that density matrix. We are tracing out A now, and we have the local density matrix of B. So someone measuring B locally, an operator of the detector, will only have access to this on its own, on their own, in general. So when they do measurements here, if they find something that is proportional to lambda A and lambda B, they can know if lambda A, to begin with, exists or not. Okay? So this thing contains information about A and is locally accessible to B. All right, so this is a signaling term. This will contain the leading order information, the leading order in terms of the coupling strengths, signaling from A to B. Right, so up all the way. All right. Maybe that's how they break, I don't know. All right, so assumption now. We assume that the two detectors are originally uncorrelated. So far, I didn't have to assume anything about the state of the two detectors. But to continue computing now, to trace one of them, I need to assume what the initial state of the two detectors was. Let's assume that they're initially uncorrelated, which makes sense in a communication scenario. The receiver and the emitter are uncorrelated at the beginning of the communication. So, again, assuming rho AB 0 is rho A 0 tensor rho B 0, rho B signal, that, remember again, the leading order correction that is at pure signaling simplifies to okay. We have the two switchings. It's basically doing that trace over there, huh? Just things simplify a lot. You get the trace of M A of T rho A that, and you also get twice I the imaginary part of the calligraphic Wyman and here you get the commutator that anyway I'm going to write it MB T prime rho B minus rho B MB T prime. Imaginary part of this. And yeah, no parentheses. To get this, we have used, remember, the properties of the Wyman. Remember that if in the Wyman function, if you switch the arguments, you get the complex conjugate. So we have used that Wyman Tx T prime x prime conjugate. It's equal to Wyman of T prime x prime Tx. All right? That's how I got twice imaginary. All right, this is something that I use, so let's just put it in a... We've used this to get this from up there. All right, so this expression, let's put it in a representation. I mean, these detectors are qubits, as in like two-level quantum systems. If you remember, they're unruly with detectors, two-level quantum systems. Let's pick a matrix representation for them because it's useful, okay? In particular, rho b has a very simple matrix representation. It's a qubit, so it's a 2x2 matrix representation. So let's pick it. Okay, it's convenient to write it like that. So let's represent. So for the detector of b, so we're going to assume that G, the ground state, 1, 0. The excited state, 0, 1, for example. Okay. That means with that representation, the monopole moment is, call it tau here, but it's fine, call it tau, 0, e to the minus I omega nu tau e to the I omega nu tau 0, right? Sigma x multiplied by those phases. And in that state representation, rho a, the originally uncorrelated states that, remember, we assume it was rho a tensor rho b at 0, 0. Let's just call it AA, BB, B star B, sorry, BA, B star A, B, sorry, 1 minus AA, tensor, well, the same thing, but with Bs. All right, this is just, let's pick a matrix representation that will make writing things easier. Everyone happy with that? You've done this before, 1,000 times, right? Questions?
The density matrices, rho A and rho B, don't have zeros in that expression for rho B signal?
No. Why do you want them to have zeros?
Up there.
Where? Sorry?
The expression for rho b signal, when you're tracing out, you have your initial uncorrelated.
Ah, well, yeah, the notation was heavy enough. Yeah, imagine that they don't have zeros. No, these are evolved. They used to have t's if we want. Okay. They're corrections. Remember, in the corrections that are up there, you have t's because it's after a time evolution, okay? And again, the notation was heavy enough, so I didn't include them, but these are evolved, okay? They're not the original ones. The original ones always have zeros.
Yeah.
Yeah. The ones before the communication started. So this is nothing but just picking a matrix representation to write this thing. All right, then we know we can evaluate all the things that we had before. So for example, in this representation, well, the trace is, the full trace is representation independent, as you would expect. So kind of misleading to say that, but whatever. I'm going to write things that are not. The trace of MAT rho A is twice the real part of BA e to the I omega AT. And this commutator that we have here, the commutator MB and rho B0, which is this commutator here, T prime. Maybe that's very difficult to read. MB of T prime rho B0. That commutator that shows up here in this matrix representation, you can write as minus twice I imaginary of B, B, E to the I omega B T prime, then here E to the minus I omega B T prime, 1 minus twice AB. Here you get the conjugate of that. I'm not gonna write it, okay, because it takes a while. Then this is 2i is the same value. The imaginary part of B, B, e to the I omega B T prime. As it should be, because the corrections, the Dyson expansion, remember what the Dyson expansion has as a property, is that it preserves the trace. Therefore, all the corrections at a given order have to be traceless, because row zero, the original one, which is right there, has trace one, okay? All right, so another thing that we will substitute in is the imaginary part of the Smear-Weinmann. Who remembers what the imaginary part of the Weinmann was? I mean, remember, the Smear-Weinmann is on the last line there. It's an integral over a real variable of some real function times some real function of the Weinmann. So if we take the conjugate, of that, the conjugate just goes on the Weinmann. Who remembers what the imaginary part of the Weinmann was?
The commutator.
Precisely, the field commutator. This imaginary part of the Weinmann, of the calligraphic Weinmann, would be an integral over the Smearings on the field commutator. All right, so that allows me to write the final step on this derivation, which is rho 2 is equal to twice minus infinity to infinity dt, dt prime minus infinity to infinity xi a t xi b t prime real part of this thing, real part of, remember here we have that trace. So you see in this term, we have terms that depend on the density matrix of A. Real part of BA, e to the I omega AT. Interesting enough, the dependence on A at this leading order depends on the BA coefficient, which is a coherence. It's not a diagonal term of A, huh? Just saying, that may be relevant. Okay, anyway, and then this matrix that I have here. So let me just call it MB T prime, just not to write it again. I don't want to bore you too much, just the necessary amount. Okay? And something that I'm gonna call calligraphic C T T prime. And this calligraphic C T T prime, it's I integral nx, integral nx prime of the Smearings and the expectation value of the commutator of the field tx t prime, x prime, on the state row field zero. Ha! Look at this. Ah, this is signal. B signal, that's what I call B signal. Now look, let's look at this. The leading order signaling term is an integral over, well, depends on the initial state of A, so it's definitely a signal term. You can read out, I mean, it depends because it's also multiplied by lambda A, all right? But it also depends on the state of A, depends on the coherences in that basis of the state of A. Depends on an integral over C, tt prime. That integral over C is an integral over the commutator. Now, what happens if A and B, their smearings, and their time windows are space-like separated? What's the value of the commutator of Poincaré invariant theory when the support, these Fs, and the integrals over time that we have outside are space-like separated? The regions of integration are space-like separated. What's the value of the commutator between two space-like separated points?
Zero.
It's zero. We call that condition microcausality. Microcausality is a property of the quantization of relativistic fields, of, in general, Poincaré invariant. I mean, I guess it's synonymous. I mean, not going to get into subtleties. This commutator, by the way, it's the expectation of the commutator on rho, but for free theories, the commutator is what? It's proportional to what? Who remembers that? So as an operator in the algebra of the field, what operator is the commutator? Multiple of the identity. The commutator is a C number. So this thing is independent of the initial state of the field. Independent of the initial state of the field. You've computed commutators before, right? In fact, people tend to write them without the expectations, even when they show with the expectation, because they're proportional to the identity, precisely. Ha. Does anyone know, have you computed the commutator of a scalar free scalar field in different dimensions? Has anyone done it here or seen it? Yeah, I know you have. Who else? All right, it's a very interesting object, huh? Very interesting. And don't worry, we will learn so much about it. Because this is key to the unexpected stuff. This is just the math, so you show that I'm not making anything up, and you can reproduce it. But here things start to get weird. As in like with the classical intuition thing. To begin with, this depends on a coherence, huh? And we'll see what that means. But not only that, the leading order signaling term is independent on the initial state of the field. You may have a very noisy state of the field. That signaling term doesn't care. That is very unusual. When you are signaling, you usually have a signal and a noise, right? Okay. So there will be a correction on the clicking rate of this detector, but look at this. And this is really funny. Let's think about what order should be a process of communication in the classical sense. Say that A couples to the field and emits a photon, if we want. What is the probability of that happening? Say that you start in the vacuum, to simplify things. Start in the field vacuum. We have computed that. What's the probability of A getting de-excited if C starts with an excited state? What's the probability of getting de-excited? What order in perturbation theory is it? We computed that several days ago. Remember the order? Was it order one? Or was it order two? Don't remember? Okay, I'll tell you. It was order two. You can check back in your notes. If you start in the vacuum state of the field and you start with an excited state, the probability of getting de-excited is order two. Okay. What is the probability of getting excited? What order is the probability of getting excited? Say that you have an excitation in the field. That's also order two. What would be the probability, what would be the leading order probability to this process of exchanging a real photon? A emits a photon on the field, and then that photon travels and is captured by B and excited. What would be the probability of that happening for real? Order four. It's very unlikely. It's already unlikely that you decay and emit a photon. It's more unlikely that that precise photon is captured by B and get the B excited. That's an order four process. I mean, we see it all the time because we emit so many photons. But it's a very, very low order, but it's a fourth order process. Now, what we're getting here is not fourth order, it's order two. But there is no real photon exchange mediated by this. These processes are not real photon exchange at all. If you want to call it virtual photon exchange, be my guest. I am not gonna do that because I don't like virtual photons, the picture of virtual photons, because it's something perturbative. And I want to talk about things that exist, okay? But this correction, it's a correction that is two orders stronger than the classical process that has classical analog, which is the exchange of energy between the two detectors. Ha. So what's going on here? I mean, we know of processes that don't involve exchange of photons like this. Question. Can you know if you're in a cavity or not? Can you know if there's a mirror over there? Can I know if there's a mirror over there? There's always been a mirror here, but it just arrived. Can I know? I mean, of course I can look at myself in the mirror, but can I know earlier than that? What about if I feel a Casimir force? If I am a metallic plate and that's a metallic plate, I'm gonna feel attraction to the plate. You know that? The Casimir force? The Casimir force will not take too long to act. The moment I'm here, I'm gonna just feel the attraction. Because of course, the mirror was there forever. Okay? So this is pretty similar to this kind of Casimir-like interactions. So this is kind of like, A did something to the field. That something to the field is not there anymore or whatever. I don't care about capturing the garbage that A did, that left there. But the field has changed. And that change is felt by B. Not because B collects the garbage, it's because the field is no longer the same. Something happened to that field, it's altered. So this is connected with what we're gonna see. Even if the energy exchange, I'll remind you, the energy exchange happens at order 4, but something happens before that. Now, do we see that in the classical world where we cannot control the quantum antennas too much? Do we see it? Would we see it? What do you think? What do you think based on this expression? Would we see it? In mind, my antenna is classical. What can, if my antenna was classical, what are the states that my antenna could have? Say still two levels, but classical. What can it be? Either excited or ground, no? Maybe a statistical mixture of them, but either excited or ground. Some statistical mixture of excited and ground. What would that be like?
No B terms.
Huh?
No B terms.
No B terms. Therefore, what would happen with this term? It would disappear. If my antennas were classical, this kind of Casimir-like, let's call it Casimir-like term, would not be there. Because if they're classical, in the eigenbasis, I would have no coherences. I would have either the excited, the excited state or the ground state, the ground state or the excited state or a statistical mixture of both, only diagonal elements. But I would not have coherences. This term right here, this first order or leading order signaling term is only present if my antennas are quantum. If my antennas are classical, I would not see them. And then is when the fun starts. Because this object is particularly interesting. Then again, you see how the model is causal. So this thing is zero when the two detectors are space-like separated. B will know nothing about A unless there's causal contact between them. Ha! Questions? Little exercise for you for tomorrow. I haven't finished yet, though. But just so you have some fun with it. Check somewhere or compute, because it's very easy to compute, the commutator of a scalar field, massless scalar field, for 1+1 dimensions, 2+1 dimensions, 3+1 dimensions. And then we chat about it tomorrow a bit, because there's something funny with them. The three-dimensional one you may have seen often, the three-dimensional one is proportional to a light cone delta. So the commutator in 3+1D, flat spacetime we're talking, has support only on the light cone. Not inside the light cone, but on the light boundary of the light cone. Is that true in other dimensions? who knows the commutator in 1 plus 1d? What's it like? Where is the support of the commutator in 1 plus 1d? Say this is my point tx, and these are my points t prime x prime. This is the light cone. We know that, of course, the commutator is zero, strictly zero, on space-like separation. That we know. In 3 plus 1d, the commutator is a delta supported only on the light cone. It's more than that, but proportional to a delta supported on the light cone. What is it in 1 plus 1d? In 1 plus 1d, it's constant inside the light cone. It's some positive constant here and some negative constant here. That's what it is. In 2 plus 1 dimensions, well, it decays inside the light cone, but it has support inside the light cone. In 4 plus 1, same thing, not in 5 plus 1. And that's something we're going to discuss a little bit. It's called the strong Huygens principle. And we're going to discuss that a little bit because that's going to be super important as to when you can communicate. 1 plus 1d is particularly teaching because in 1 plus 1d, if you compute, imagine that I couple here the detector, you compute the stress energy density here, you know where the stress energy density goes? The renormalized stress energy density starts being zero everywhere. Then Alice does Alice's thing. You know what happens with the stress energy density? It propagates where? On the future light cone only. On the light, it's a massless field. On the light part, on the light boundary of the future light cone. It does not leak inside. That's another exercise you can have if you want. It's very easy to. It's more lengthy though, because you know, expectation value of stress energy density, expectation value of a square of a field. Same with the commutator, but then tricks in the commutator simplify a lot. If you compute it, you will find that the t mu nu that Alice creates here, different from zero, will propagate only on the light cone. Energy travels at the speed of light. That's not surprising. Massless field, right? But the field commutator is non-zero inside the light cone. And that means that even though the energy that Alice puts into the field only propagates at the speed of light, someone here, that someone here missed the signal, literally. I mean, yeah, the energy already passed. I came later. Well, you can still find out about Alice. Alice can communicate with you, even if the energy you sent does not reach me. Look at that. Well, I mean, it's surprising only halfway, because we knew that this is not exchange of energy anyways, is it? This is a kind of a Casimir thing. So Alice doing this changed the field. The field amplitude is different elsewhere. Things have changed. The energy goes on the light cone, but the change goes on the full, on the boundary of the light cone. The change goes on the full time-like area. And that's the change that is felt by B. All right, questions. Okay, so the last 5 minutes, I'm gonna show you something. But it's totally not intuitive, is it? It's kind of safe in the sense that if my antennas were classical, it wouldn't be there. So not surprisingly, you haven't seen it too much. In 3 plus 1D, flat spacetime goes on the light cone, so not distinguishable too much from other things. But it's funny. It's very funny. Isn't it funny? Okay. Then again, you can derive the whole thing. No trick here. You have all the ingredients. You don't need to trust me on this. And you better not trust me. Okay. It's thinking about it. Now, this is how I started talking about these things usually. How do we conceive communication through massless fields? Which is something we do all the time. All right, so reasonable properties of it. Communication is mediated by real energy carrying quanta. There is quanta emitted at the emitter, and there's quanta received at the receiver. And the information is carried by those quanta. Okay, there's really carrier waves, if we want, taking the information from one place to another. This is supposed to be a representation of this the laser experiment to measure the distance from the moon to Earth. It's kind of cool. Anyway. Information flows are carried by an energy flow, meaning that, yeah, information reaches you when energy reaches you. I mean, the average here is to avoid people being very smart, as in like, but there are situations where you can send information without sending energy if you prearrange, because you can say, if I called you tonight, I'll go to the theater. If not, I won't go. Then he doesn't call, and you know that he's not coming, even though he didn't send any energy, right? But on average, if you keep doing that every day and you want to go one day at least, you need to send some information, some energy, okay? So information reaches you when energy reaches you. That's reasonable, again, under the same classical assumption. Ah, yeah, another one. Communication is only possible at the speed of light, which means, of course, not faster, but also not slower. Because a massless field, the signal goes at the speed of light. And that means that if you miss the beam, you miss the message. You're not there. I beamed an empty chair. I don't expect someone to come an hour later and find out what I sent, because the beam is gone. These expressions that we have here challenge every single one of those assumptions. Okay? So the thing is, the important thing is that we're going to focus on the next lecture, is that, okay, so it seems that if my antennas are quantum and they couple to a quantum field, there is some non-trivial signal in effect that is proportional to an integral over the commutator, and the commutator is an object that is not necessarily doing any of those things, okay? So happens that in flat 3 plus 1D seems to do it, such luck, but it will not be the case in, optical fibers. It would not be the case in curved spacetimes, as in like, it would not be the case in cosmology, depending on what field you're talking about. So there's a lot to tell about this story. Apparently there is a way to communicate that involves no exchange of energy whatsoever. It's not an emitter emits photons, a receiver receives photons. It seems that information lingers there, as in like massless field, I beam an empty chair. Apparently, I can get information later on, if I can later on. Think 1 plus 1D, the commutator is a constant. It's not gonna care how much you wait. The information will be as much as it was. There's an echo, people who wrote on this about this on FIS.org would say there's an afterglow. They use the word afterglow. It's a good one, though, for popular science, I guess. There's some imprinted signal in the field that can be read by Bob. If Alice at least has a quantum antenna. And we will talk about a simple protocol in which you can actually use this to communicate. That protocol that I'm going to talk about is what we call quantum collect calling. It's called quantum collect calling. The reason it's called quantum collect calling is because the energy bill is paid by the receiver, not by the sender. Sender sends one thing, you can have many receivers, the receivers have to put energy to read out the message. Anyway, questions? I'm hoping that I will be able to do this topic fully tomorrow, or if not tomorrow, and a little bit of the day after. And the rest, we're gonna see another cool protocol as well, which is quantum energy teleportation and how to use it to do exotic spacetimes. Anyway, think about it. Try to compute the commutator if you can or if you have time. Maybe you don't have time. I don't know. It could have been a nice exercise now that I think about it for them. We can still add it, no? Yeah. All right, maybe you don't need to do it yet. Computing the commutator in the different dimensions is kind of a pastime. It's nice. It's one or two tricks that you need to use to simplify to the constant thing in the 1 plus 1D case, but they're super simple though, so I think it's fun. Anyway, I'll see you tomorrow. I hope that I've destroyed a little bit your preconceptions about communication with massless fields. If not, there's still time for me to do it.